Well, our investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe has outdone herself this time. Some incredible stories. And we're going to start in just a moment with one that is going to be announced within days. Within days. And Linda will have a preview for us when we come back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back. Linda Moulton Howe with us with a number of great stories for us. And Linda, of course, a major story will be announced sometime next week. We're going to be covering that with Richard Dolan and some other experts, but this is exciting. What do you think of all this?
Well, you are right that the upcoming Cinco de Mayo event that's being produced by Jaime Maussan in Mexico City is about 1947 vintage color Kodachrome slides of an alleged non-human after autopsy retrieved from one of the many described crashes that had occurred in Roswell. And if we go back to July of 1947, there were at least three within a 3 or 4 day period, according to some documents. So depending upon how this goes in Mexico City, it could be another one of those breakthrough steps, getting us closer and closer to the real fact of what happened in Roswell, New Mexico, back in July 1947, at least. And so this means, George, that this coming July will be the 68th anniversary when manager, I know it's hard to believe, 68 years ago, when ranch manager William Mac Brazel discovered these strange pieces of thin, silverish metal where something odd had crashed down, left groove marks in his sheep pasture about 75 miles northwest of Roswell. And back then, what we were doing behind the scenes, what we have been finding from documents and people who talked before they died, is that intelligence agents were gathering up all the debris from Brazel's sheep pasture for top secret government analysis in places like then Wright Field and Los Alamos, some of the highest top secret places in the United States. And one of those agents was Lieutenant Colonel Jesse Marcel from the 509th Bomb Group in Roswell. And Colonel Marcel was also ordered to fly this strange silver metallic debris material to Wright Field, Ohio, that later became Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And Marcel first stopped at Fort Worth to show the discovery to General Ramey, who had a civilian press photographer take photos of himself posing with his chief of staff, Colonel Thomas Dubose. And they had this silver weather balloon material for this concocted photograph. And Colonel Marcel deliberately, according now to history looking back, deliberately substituted the silver weather balloon to convince the media and the public that the first Colonel Blanchard press release that went around the world, and I'm looking at a copy of it, it was dated July 8, 1947. It was the front page, the upper half, quote, Roswell Daily Record, RAAF, that's the Roswell Army Airfield, captures flying saucer on ranch in Roswell region. Well, that was, according to Ramey later, a mistake that Colonel Blanchard had made. However, Colonel Jesse Marcel finally went on the record about the actual fact of his investigation in that sheep pasture for a 1979 videotaped interview. And he said, quote, there were many bits of metallic foil that looked like but were not aluminum. No matter how often we crumpled it, it regained its original shape again. And besides that, they were indestructible, even with a sledgehammer, close quote. And that's exactly what rancher Mac Brazel later told people as well, quote, one of the pieces looked like something on the order of tinfoil, except that it wouldn't tear. You could wrinkle it and lay it back down, and it immediately resumed its original shape. Quite pliable, but you couldn't crease or bend it like ordinary metal. It was almost like a plastic, but definitely still metallic. Dad once said that the Army had once told him it was not anything made by us, close quote. Well, now we're in 2015, and recently I received an email that stated, quote, my father told me about a meeting in 1970 to 71 time period that took place at Sunnyvale Lockheed Martin facility, where he was called into a room with four other top-rated engineers. There is what looked like a square piece of aluminum wadded up into a ball and slowly flattened itself back out completely smooth. It was also heated to a reddish-white glow and could be held without burning, meaning burning the hands, close quote. This writer, to me, is Timothy Wayne Durham, son of Lockheed Martin Sunnyvale engineer Joe Durham, now deceased. Tim gave me permission to use his and his father's real names along with some evidence from his father's work that is now in my Earth Files report. And the following recorded phone interview is about his dad's firsthand description of handling this material. Quote, not from here, close quote. Before his father died in January 2011, Tim had researched various types of non-humans described in books and the internet. And when he asked his tight-lipped father about the extraterrestrial descriptions, Joe Durham told his son, quote, you have no idea, close quote. Here now from Squaw Valley, California, is Tim Durham.
This meeting took place when he was very high up with his clearances. Otherwise, they wouldn't have came to him. He had already worked on all the manned spaceflight missions, the Apollo, the Gemini, all through those, all the way into the shuttle program. And when he retired, that's what he was working on. Amidst all that, he was involved with the Trident missile program, and he had gained clearances through that. Around 93 is basically when he told me about this. It was back near 1970 or 71 when this took place, because he was doing a lot of odd things and staying away from the house for like a week or 2 weeks at a time. He was involved in the Trident missile at that time.
Okay, so that I understand, he is describing to you an event that took place in the 1970 to 71 time frame when he worked on the Trident missile system.
Yes.
And he is at the Sunnyvale Lockheed Martin facility.
Yes, that's correct. And then the first thing that he explained to me is he went through about 10 minutes of describing how the CIA was involved in his job. How the CIA would keep tabs on even me and my brother. They would know where we were at any time. We were being closely watched because of the clearances that he had gotten. He told me that he was called in on a meeting to go to a certain building, and at that building, when he went into the building, there were four other engineers. I don't know if they were all from that Lockheed facility. Some might have been from Southern California, maybe out in Georgia, but they all convened at this building in Sunnyvale, California. There were my father plus four other engineers. They were in a room. They waited there. Five gentlemen came in. They were all five of them dressed in black. I hate to use the word men in black because it sounds so like movie-ish or something, but one of the gentlemen had on a white shop coat. And he was carrying a very sophisticated-looking aluminum briefcase. It had lights on it. They went through their secrecy. You know, they were talked to and told that this is top secret. You can't talk about it. And they signed some papers. They were escorted into another room. Just the gentleman with the white shop coat went with them to this other room. So there's the man in black with the shop coat and the briefcase, and then five engineers, including my father. The gentleman with the briefcase put the briefcase on the table. He went through some process there to open it. He took out what my father described as 6 by 6 inch piece of aluminum, flat, and he laid it on the table, closed the briefcase, picked up the piece of aluminum, and wadded it with one hand like you would wad up a piece of aluminum foil. He had his hand closed down, placed that in my dad's open hand, and my dad watched it as it uncrinkled itself slowly and ended up in a flat configuration again. No wrinkles, no lines, no nothing, smooth as glass. This process went through all the other four engineers. When they finished doing that, the gentleman took out the briefcase, a little small propane torch, I believe, heated this material up, and my dad said he was using like pliers to hold the material, and he heated this piece of aluminum till it was glowing orange. My dad said there was areas that were white because it was so hot. And then he took that piece and he put it in my father's hand. My father said it did not burn him. That's what he was concerned. He said, it's going to burn my skin off. Put it in my father's hand. He felt a slight bit of heat from it, but nothing compared to something that's 2,200 degrees. I've worked with metal, not aluminum, but I know that when it's orange, it's above 2,000 degrees. The material was placed in my father's hands while it was still orange, and it remained orange all through every one of the other engineers getting that piece put in their hand so they could feel it.
So how is it possible that something that we know terrestrially, when it's orange and metal, is 2,000 or above degrees, how could they have ever had it in their hands without being burned?
He said it wasn't from here, because nothing we have on this planet could do that. And I think he came to the conclusion that that piece of material came out of Roswell, and they were still trying to figure out what its content was, what it was made of.
Your father, working at Sunnyvale Lockheed Martin facility in 1970 to 71, then 20 years later, was telling you what happened, and that in the early 70s, they still had no idea what or how metal that was retrieved from some kind of UFO vehicle could operate the way it did, crumpling, coming back flat, being exposed to 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit temperature, and they could still handle it in their hands, that this was still a huge unknown.
It would seem so. If they had already analyzed this material and knew what it was, they wouldn't be turning to top engineers within the Lockheed structure to seek help trying to understand what this was.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't necessarily mean it came from the July 4th, 1947 incident. It could have come from some after. It could have come from the downing of a craft in Mexico. I believe the CIA has intervened all over the world in getting vehicles. But it was definitely not anything that was manufactured on this planet.
Right. Did anybody explain to him about who the five men dressed in black who had the silver metal briefcase that had lights on it, who they were?
They were with the Central Intelligence Agency. After my father passed away, I talked to his brother. And this is very interesting because I went to my uncle, who's my father's brother, and I told him I had something that I desperately needed to talk to him about. So we went out on the porch, and I proceeded to go through exactly what I told you and told him the story. Never once did he show any kind of emotion on his face, just quietly listened. And I said, well, do you think this is true? Do you believe it? And he looked at me without expression, and he said, I know it's true. And I said, what do you mean you know it's true? He says, because my brother-in-law was there during the meeting. I says, oh, he was an engineer. He said, no, he was CIA.
Did either your father or your father's brother ever indicate to you when they were alive that they had firsthand knowledge that we were not alone and that extraterrestrial technology was a major priority in the United States government?
They didn't talk to me directly about that, especially my uncle, but my father always seemed to walk around like he knew the truth. At the time when he was alive, I was doing a lot of research. And I might have spent 10 minutes telling him some stuff that I found out. And he would say to me, "You have no idea." He would hint or give me some other indication that he knew it was true already. And I would walk away convinced that's what he was telling me. He was telling me, "Yeah, you're on the right track."
Your father, being a man of few words, chuckling and saying, "You have no idea," when you are talking about four different races of extraterrestrial biological entities, is saying a lot.
Well, he always told me that what I was doing was dangerous.
Why should it be dangerous?
I have no idea what his meaning of dangerous was. It involved the CIA, it involved secrets that are supposed to stay secret, and it just the fact that he's telling me, "Don't say anything about this until I'm dead," it had a great deal of secrecy and importance to somebody.
In the end of his life, he died in what year?
2011, January.
And his brother died?
Before Christmas.
Of 2014?
Yes.
He did say those words, "Don't say anything about this to anyone until I'm dead."
Yes, he did.
And that's why you feel that you can come to me now in April of 2015.
Yeah, and it angers me that there are people out there that have all this control and they could care less about the rest of the human race.
And George, in that very important 1997 release book, The Day After Roswell, Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Corso described his work in the Pentagon for General Arthur Trudeau, handpicked by President Dwight Eisenhower to be the United States Army's first head of research and development. The two generals knew each other from World War II and trusted each other, and they were Army. Colonel Corso told me before he died in 1998, that General Trudeau took him personally to a metal file cabinet in the Pentagon office where a few different extraterrestrial technologies described as extraterrestrial were being kept for secure safety. The General and Colonel Corso had agreed that they would work with trusted scientists Hermann Oberth and Wernher von Braun while they distributed various exotic technologies from UFO crash retrievals to American corporations, especially defense contractors, to be back engineered and patented. No one at the corporations would know except the original contact by General Arthur Trudeau and Colonel Corso that the artifact to be researched and back engineered did not come from human terrestrial technology. Quote, "That way, the existing defense contract becomes the cover for what we're developing. Nothing is ever out of the ordinary because we're never starting up anything that hasn't already been started up in a previous contract. What we're doing is mixing technology we're developing in with technology not of this earth. And we'll let the companies that we're contracting with apply for the patents themselves. And then if they own the patent, we will have completely reverse engineered the non-terrestrial technology. Nobody will ever know. We won't even tell the companies we're working with where this technology comes from. As far as the world will know, the history of the patent is the history of the invention. It is the perfect cover." Close quote.
Great story, Linda. Makes you think, doesn't it?
Well, I think this is the fact.
Stick with us. Linda's got more stories. We'll be back with her in a moment. Her website, earthfiles.com. And Linda will be continuing with some of her incredible stories. That'll be next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. We're with Linda Moulton Howe. Now, Linda, this next story is back to these loud, strange sounds again.
I'm telling you, it is something. It was a month ago on March 24th, it was 9 p.m. local time, that a very loud, strange, and scary sound was heard by hundreds and hundreds of people above Cannock Chase, England. The deep roar, as it was described, lasted, and a lot of people said, up to at least 3 minutes before a huge triangular aerial craft emerged in the air with a solid, unblinking red light in each of its three corners. Eyewitnesses said that this huge triangle moved very slowly near rooftop levels. Think about that, rooftops. Many turned to social media afraid that the loud object that was so low was going to hit the ground. A local paranormal investigator there named Lee Brickley wrote on a paranormal Canic Chase blog that the noise was similar, quote, to an old World War II bomber. Before anything could be seen with the naked eye, there was a deep and very loud droning. After around 3 minutes, the craft came into sight. It seemed incredibly large and astonishingly low in the sky, with three red lights that were easily noticeable. The UFO traveled very slowly, and many people thought that it was about to crash, close quote. But like a disappearing ghost, it all just went away. Canic Chase is in a very beautiful countryside of Staffordshire County, England. It's about 20 miles north of that large industrial city of Birmingham. Since the 19th century, local press have carried reports from many people who described their seeing strange black dogs, werewolves, big cats, UFOs, and even a few Bigfoot cases. And to the west, in Telford and Shrewsbury, residents there have long reported UFO abductions and lots of high strangeness over decades, including a recent upsurge of unusual aerial phenomena, and now this big roar. This is current. This is March. Well, it was also during my last March Coast broadcast that I was doing an update about the increasing numbers of deep roars, strange booms, and metallic sounds that people have been hearing and reporting in many parts of the United States. And they've been reporting, just like England did, to law enforcement, social media, local TV stations, radio stations, and so forth. And it turned out that after I was on the broadcast a month ago, not knowing that March 26th what was happening in England and learning about it subsequently, that I ended up, not long afterwards, receiving an email from a South Kingstown, Rhode Island resident. He is he's retired from his administrator work in the Department of Defense. He asked for anonymity, so I am calling him John Smith. But he is knowledgeable about various military aircraft and nearby Otis Air National Guard base in Massachusetts, which is about 80 miles east of South Kingstown, Rhode Island. And when he wrote to me, he said that he has heard in 2011, three different nights in a row, a Friday, Saturday, and a Monday, a huge, deep roar that was associated with something that he kept thinking of, a long triangular shape, maybe something like an F-14 or an F-15, but with nothing like the light patterns and moving extremely slowly, and again, at rooftop levels. So tonight, even though he is going to be known as John Smith, I think this is an extraordinarily important report that echoes the recent event in England. And here now from South Kingstown, Rhode Island, is John Smith.
This was a cold January night. It was 6:45, and I hear this jet-like sound approaching. The sound was different from any other jet that I've heard. It was a very, very loud, deep, bass-like sound, almost reverberating. I'm looking up, and all of a sudden, this thing comes over my rooftop. It's flashing white lights, and then as I watched in amazement, it did a maneuver that no regular jet could do. It slowed down, and it made a U-turn further down in the sky over the rooftops and came back the same way. And as it came back over my house, the white lights changed all to red lights, flashed to red, and then back to white as it moved away. My knees were knocking because I knew this was not a normal jet. I knew it was extraterrestrial or at least of some type of construction that was top secret. I would say it was Delta-shaped, triangular shaped. It looked like it had two wings, but I saw no afterburner. and the sound was quite different. Then there was another one. After that one passed away, there was another one further away on the other side towards the ocean more. So there were two of them at least. This was Thursday night, and then I watched them both head out towards the east, towards the ocean, still flying very low over the rooftops and making this incredible bass-like roar. They were dipping down and dipping up and doing these weird maneuvers, and then they disappeared. So I called the police, I reported it, and the dispatcher said, well, you're the second person. He said, I just got another call on it. I said, yeah. I said, well, these things, if they're U.S., they shouldn't be flying like that over our rooftops. He said, I'll make a note of it here, and that was it for that night. But I had a distinct feeling they were going to come back the next night. I don't know how I had that feeling, but I did. Sure enough, they came back the following night at exactly the same time, 6:45. And I heard the same song, said, oh my God, they're coming back. This time, it was even more odd because what came over my house was some type of a jet-like, seemed like it was different than the first one that came the night before. But it came right over my house, and I'm on the phone talking to the police dispatcher trying to describe what I'm seeing. And I held the phone up so he could hear the roar of this thing. What I saw underneath the fuselage as it came right over my rooftop were two large, red, unblinking, kind of blood red lights. That's all that was on this craft. There were no other lights on this one. That one came right over my rooftop, really very, very close. As it headed away, this is the amazing part, it was accompanied by a white ball of light, maybe like basketball size, but they were flying parallel to each other as they headed to the east. The jet-like thing veered off to the south. The ball of light continued east towards the ocean, towards Narragansett Bay. I tried to inquire as to what these craft were and what they were doing flying at rooftop levels, which is illegal, if even if they were our own craft. When I was talking to the police outside that whole time, I was talking to him right as it went over my house. I was telling him what I was seeing. He says, what do you think they are? I said, they look like UFOs. When I said UFOs, I'm calling the state police. Then he hung up.
What police department?
South Kingstown Police Department in Wakefield. Wakefield is a village in the town of South Kingstown.
What about that white glowing ball?
I thought, if anything's a UFO, that was a UFO. As I looked, I see the white ball following it at the same rooftop level. So they were in communication with each other. I associated them both as related to each other somehow. And I would say ally rather than enemy, because nothing bad happened to either one of them. Mm-hmm. It's almost like there was a communication between them, and then they veered off.
So the camouflage jet goes off, but the white glowing ball that was next to it continues out to the ocean.
Yes.
One of the questions in the UFO phenomena has been how much of the extraterrestrial intelligence or intelligences are using the oceans as their territory on this planet where most humans cannot go.
Well, that's interesting because the first UFO I ever saw came up out of the ocean. When I was camping in Rhode Island here by the shore when I was 15, we see this bright star-like object come up out of the ocean, zigzag at 45-degree angles, almost in a jerky kind of motion. It picked up speed and then just shot into space. And that came up out of the ocean.
What year?
That was 1965. After that, I believed.
In your email to me, you said that the craft on the second sighting, the second night, had the outline of an F-14. Can you explain that?
It had more of an outline of a jet. I used the F-14 as an example. It was a Marden-shaped jet, but with no other lights on it. There were no normal navigational lights, just two large, red, unblinking lights that were right above my head as it went over.
On that second night, where you had the impression that there was a triangle masquerading as an F-14, but
yes,
you said the sound was not right. Why, to your human ear, it was not an F-14?
No, it wasn't an F-14. It was some type of manufactured craft to imitate one of ours. There was no afterburner. I saw it come right over with the two red lights. There were no other lights on it. And the sound was a deep bass roar. You could hear it when it was way out of sight. You could still hear that sound reverberate through the air.
Was it rattling the windows or any part of where you were?
No, but I felt it through my body as I was outside. It went right over my head. It was so loud, I held it up to the police dispatcher as it went over. After it passed, he could still hear it going away. And I said, it looks like a UFO. He says, UFO, I'm calling the state police. He was scared. And then he hung up.
You knew from your life and your work as an administrator for the Department of Defense and other work that you had done, that you were looking at the bottom of something that was triangular shaped. It made you think of an F-14, but that it could not have been a terrestrial F-14.
No. I think it was something that was manufactured to imitate one of our jets. And then the following Monday morning, I was outside at 11 o'clock with the cable installer, and that same bass sound, exactly the same as the first two nights, I could hear it approaching. I said, oh my God, they're coming back. And this time, it was just at rooftop level or a little bit above. It was a full-length F-15 is what it appeared to me. And it had no markings on it. The nose of the F-15 was a slightly different color than the rest, and it kind of suggested that it was a model that was put together. That was my impression. But just as it came right over my house, it flipped on its side at a 45-degree angle, so I could not see into the cockpit and could only see the underside of the craft. And again, no markings. There was no afterburner at all. And with that much speed and sound, there should have been something coming out of the afterburner, but there was nothing. The sound, to me, felt like it was broadcast rather than manufactured by the engine. It seemed like there was broadcast from speakers is what the sound felt like to me, that it was artificial. In fact, the whole craft seemed like it was artificial. As it passed and went away, I immediately called the police again. And this time I hit a brick wall. They were no longer allowed to speak about it.
If we have extraterrestrial intelligences that are camouflaging whatever their technology is to look like our aircraft, what are the implications for you?
Well, the implications are they could be everywhere and unnoticed, and they could be hiding in plain sight, making close observations of us, taking data from us. They could be working with our own military. They have the technology to do that, I believe, to imitate anything that looks like ours. I think where they followed up was they didn't get the sound right. And the lights were not normal navigational lights. And the maneuvers of these craft flying at house top level, that's something our own military does not do.
Mm-hmm. The sound, was it heard by any of your neighbors?
Yes, my neighbor next door heard it. I just said, oh, well, I guess it was a jet. I said, no, it wasn't a jet. I did have another friend who lives further down in the next little village, about 6 miles from me, and I talked to him, and he saw them also. And he said they were not our jets. I called the National Guard the next day because what happened, well, I'm back up a little bit. After that second night, and I made the report, there was feature on the news. So many people had called in about these craft that the news had to broadcast something. It was on Channel 10 News, and the announcer, Dan Janning, said, well, what were those strange jets that were going over South County, Rhode Island? Just jets from Otis Air Force Base. And he said, well, I guess that takes care of it. And what was odd is when he said they were stationed at Otis Air Force Base, there haven't been F-15s, any jets at Otis for the last 6 years. So I knew it was what he said was a lie. They were not from Otis Air Force Base. Their jets have been gone for 6 years. They moved them up to Westfield, Massachusetts. So I knew it was a government cover-up.
Why do you think that the government doesn't simply tell us the truth, that we're not alone in this universe, and that entities with very advanced technologies interact with this planet?
Well, I think there are two reasons. One is I think they're afraid of the public mass hysteria. I think there's another reason. Our own government could be working with these extraterrestrials on secret projects that are even scarier than just their presence.
And George, over the last couple of years, at Earth Files and on Coast, I have interviewed several people who were in California, Idaho, Wyoming, and some other places who have said that they have heard either a trumpet sound, metallic scraping sound, a roaring sound, even a boom sound. And when they have looked up in the sky, they have seen some kind of a triangular configuration, and they get the distinct impression that the triangle is broadcasting, as he said, or somehow emanating the sounds and directing to the ground. And this is a completely different hypothesis to what I was exploring a month ago with Roger Cunningham, the corporate owner, who thinks that it is because of core changes in the center of this planet that are causing changes in the mantle up to the crust, and that there is some interaction with the ionosphere and making these different sounds, and gave all the reasons why. So we have, on the one hand, the issue of the Earth demonstrating that something's happening in the core and may be related ultimately in this century to a magnetic pole flip. But on the other hand, the combination of what happened in England to hundreds of people in that one area on March 24th, John Smith going back to January of 2011, when in all of my records I have this is when the modern day phenomena of all the strange sounds began, and he is an intelligent mind who is associating the strange sound as not being quite right, as if it was being broadcast. And in these other cases where people are outside and they get some sound and they have a feeling, a human intuition, or the way their brain and their eyes and their ears are processing what is happening, they think that the object above them is broadcasting these weird sounds. Now, if both phenomena are happening, the core is changing, the Earth is heading maybe finally to a magnetic field flip again, plus non-human intelligences are involved with mimicking jets, mimicking technologies, mimicking around the world, I will never forget, if I have time to tell this, and if I don't, I'll tell it on the other side of the break.
Sure.
An engineer who had worked at Sandia told me when I was investigating animal mutilations back in 79 to 80, he said, Linda, I was driving up to Sterling, Colorado. There is train tracks that parallel the freeway. I saw a train car stopped on the tracks, and I thought, oh, Lord, there's going to be a terrible crash here. I've got to get to the next town and call somebody and tell them something has happened. When? The train car rose slowly and steadily straight up from the train track up in nowhere's land in eastern Colorado, and kept rising into the sky as high as he could see it, and disappeared. And he said to me back in that 1979 to 80 period, I think we are dealing with advanced extraterrestrial technologies that are mimicking our planet.
We sure are. Linda, great story. Did a mother come back from the dead to save her baby? That's next.